This is 1988 Tops, where every card has a story to tell. Your hosts are David McKellis and Matt Kuzma. Let's play ball.
Welcome back to 1988 Tops. David, what's our card for this week?
Our card this week is card number 769, Cecil Cooper, DH, / first baseman for the Milwaukee Brewers.
All right, Cecil Cooper, and why are we talking about Cecil today?
Sometimes a childhood memory pops into my head, and I'm convinced that I'm the only person who experienced this. And Matt, I've included in the notes an image. Are you aware of this program depicted in the image?
Never heard of it, never saw it. I'm looking in the show notes right now, and I've pulled this up on the Jumbotron. This is a cartoon that is signed by Bob Clampett, and it has what looks like some kind of dinosaur or dragon. It has the evil guy in the black coat and a hat, I think from Rocky and Bullwinkle, or he kind of looks like that, a Boris character. It's got some kind of kid wearing a beanie, and then a gentleman with some papers in his hands, and is that a pith helmet? Am I describing that right? I don't really know what pith is, except that it's the sour stuff in the skin of a grapefruit. He's got a Jetsons kind of look to him. So this is kind of the era I'm thinking of, the Jetsons 60s and 70s kind of cartoon era. Everyone's laughing and smiling, even the evil guy.
This is an image of the show Beanie and Cecil. Does that ring a bell?
Never. Nope.
I'm sometimes convinced this is like a Mandela effect where my family is the only ones who ever watched this show. We rented this show on video from Ken's World of Video. Mm. Everybody had their local chain prior to Blockbuster. We would rent this over and over again and watch this cartoon. And the reason why I think I'm the only one who knows about this is that it wasn't a particularly popular cartoon, but I think my mom watched it and thought it was funny, and so we would rent this over and over. And this was a Bob Clampett cartoon. It was based off of a puppet TV show called Time for Beanie, and Beanie is the little kid with a propeller hat, and his friend Cecil the Seasick Sea Serpent, that's that giant green thing. And they later made this into a cartoon that only lasted for 26 episodes. It was only on for one season. But in my family, if you say, "Help, Cecil, help," somebody will invariably yell, "I'm a coming, Beanie Boy." And that's Cecil. Another famous phrase is, "Nyah-uh-uh, it is I, Dishonest John." And you can guess that that is Dishonest John wearing the black. He looks like a dishonest fellow.
He does, yeah. The mustache does it.
For some reason, "Help, Cecil, help" popped into my head this week, and I thought, we have a Cecil in this set, but we also have a Cecil. Cecil Fielder, pronounced slightly different from Cecil Cooper, and I wanted to learn a little bit more about Cecil, this Cecil Cooper, a guy who I knew as an all-star, a good hitter for the Brewers, but I didn't know much more than that. Didn't know where he stood in the pantheon of all-time greats. Is he an Hall of Fame caliber? Where's he at? He thankfully has a Sabre bio by Eric Aaron. Thank you very much to Eric. And in that Sabre bio, Eric quotes Baseball Digest saying Cecil was the, quote, Rodney Dangerfield of baseball. So let's learn about a great player who didn't get no respect.
Sounds great. Let's go to the front of card 769. And we have Cecil Cooper, who is a left-handed hitter in the batter's box. This is a quintessential Brewers pose because he's got the sunglasses on. He's got the mustache and beard. He is just taken a huge cut. So he is finished his swing. The veins on his forearms are bulging on both of the interior and posterior. What is the anterior? It's anterior and posterior. On both the left and right side. On both the inside and outsides of his forearms, on both arms. And because the catcher's mitt is in view, you can tell that that ball is not in the mitt. You can tell that that ball has been launched into right field, and Cecil is admiring it. Really just poetry in motion, this picture.
You described this as the quintessential 1988 Brewers card. I did just pull up the Jim Gantner card. This is basically the same card. They even both have their prescription transition lenses in. Cecil a little bit bigger than Jim Gantner. We've had some confusing shots of swings where it was unclear where the ball was going. This one is definitely going into the outfield. That's a big hack. This is the same catcher from the 1988 Jim Gantner card. And I'm trying to figure out who that is. In the Gantner card, it almost looks like they're playing the Cubs. But on this one, you can only see the glove, just a disembodied catcher arm. But a very good-looking card for Cecil Cooper. He's got a full beard and mustache, giant glasses, giant veins, looking good. And he looks like a kaiju, an Ed Hearn-style kaiju, fitting into the entirety of the screen from tip to tail all the way in the screen.
Flip to the back, 769, Cecil Cooper, DH in first base. 6'2 and 190, looks bigger than 190 to me. Left-handed batter and thrower, drafted by the Red Sox in the sixth round of 1968. Born December 20th, 1949 in Brenham, Texas, with a home in Houston, Texas.
Brenham, Texas, about an hour from Houston. In interviews, Cecil said that he was from Independence, Texas, so also in the same county, but a slightly smaller town. He went to high school in Brenham, and this is about an hour from Houston and an hour and a half from Austin. Brenham became a city in 1844 and was selected to be the county seat of Washington County. Prior to the Civil War, about half of Washington County's population was enslaved African Americans. There was later a sizable German population that arrived in the late 19th century. Also around that time, Jewish immigrants settled in the area, establishing one of the first Orthodox congregations in Texas. In 1875, the town created the first tax-supported school system in Texas, including the creation of a segregated school for black students. The town had around 7,000 people when Cecil was born, now around 17,000. Still has a sizable African-American population, accounting for about 20% of the town. Some famous Brenhamans, not Tom, jazz and ragtime pianist William Ezell, radio personality Don Imus, gospel blues singer Blind Willie Johnson, and Hosea Garrett. Matt, were you aware of Hosea Garrett?
Yes, I've heard the name from Baylor University. So Hosea Garrett, co-founder of Baylor University, which I see here was initially in nearby Independence, Texas, but was founded in Waco, Texas in 1845, if I remember.
It later moved to Waco, Texas. Yeah. And Hosea Garrett died after he was thrown from a horse, and he is buried in Brenham. Brenham is the home and headquarters of Bluebell Creamery, founded in 1907, initially selling butter and then some ice cream locally. Bluebell expanded to the entirety of Texas and then much of the South. By 2015, it was the number two best-selling ice cream brand in the United States, despite a 2015 Listeria outbreak and that video of a girl licking one of their ice creams in a Walmart. It didn't give Bluebell the greatest press. But I think they're still going strong and people swear by this stuff. Do you have a strong opinion?
Yes, I have visited the creamery. All of it is delicious. Big fan of Bluebell.
So delicious that that girl didn't even want to take it home. She just didn't want to leave the freezer section. In 2015, Brenham also had the world's largest barbecue smoker. 75 feet long, 24 doors, attached to a tractor trailer, known as the Undisputable Cuz, not the Undisputable Cuz.
Mm.
It was for sale in 2015 for $350,000.
It's a good deal.
Put that in the show notes. A tractor trailer smoker.
If you want to do a GoFundMe for that thing, David, I'm game.
Can we park it on the street in Chicago?
Bet we can find a way.
Cecil was the youngest of 13 kids, born to Roy and O.C. Cooper. Roy worked at the local public works, and sadly, Cecil's mother, O.C., passed away when Cecil was only 10 years old. He went for a time to live with an older sister nearby, but returned to Brenham for high school. According to a 1980 Sports Illustrated article, Roy had played in the Negro Leagues, and with that background from his dad, and as we discussed in the Bill Swift episode, the athletic advantages of being the youngest child. Cecil was destined for greatness. Being the youngest of 13, he had a lot of in-house competition and coaching. His dad coached his little league team, and he had three brothers who also helped him learn how to play baseball: John, Sylvester, and Jesse. John had been a pitcher and Sylvester a catcher for Prairie View A&M, and they both later played for the barnstorming Indianapolis Clowns. The Indianapolis Clowns were the last remaining Negro Leagues team, and they played into the mid-60s. The Clowns once employed Henry Aaron, as well as female players Tony Stone and Mamie Peanut Johnson. While Cecil was growing up, John would throw in BP, and that gave him a good level of pitching to improve his bat. John also described Cecil as awkward because he was the youngest, and he was the only lefty in the family. But as he grew up, John said that he felt like he was really throwing his best stuff to his younger brother, and his little brother was hitting everything. Cooper played 3 seasons at Pickard High School, which was a segregated all-black school, and this was that same original black school that was opened in 1875. In his 3 seasons there, the team won 2 state titles. But as we discussed in the Don Baylor episode, desegregation in Texas was slow even after Brown versus the Board of Education. Integration came around the time that Cecil was growing up. So he transferred to integrated Brenham High School and played baseball at Brenham, but he hadn't really thought about going pro. He said, "Baseball was something that was always around, but I never thought about it as a career. I was just going to be a regular kid, go to college, get a job."
He was going to take classes at nearby Blinn Junior College, and then Boston Red Sox scout Dave Philly saw him play in a semi-pro game with his brother in Austin. Dave Philly had an 18-year major league career for 8 teams, and late in his career set a record with 8 consecutive pinch hits. 1,700 hits in his career, despite not playing regularly until age 26 due to World War II. Philly passed away in 2012 at the age of 91. But in 1968, as a scout, Philly made the recommendation, and the Red Sox picked Cecil in the 6th round of the 1968 draft and signed him. Cooper wasn't sure what to do. He thought about college, and he did take classes at Blinn Junior College and Prairie View A&M in the offseason, but he ultimately signed with the Red Sox and was sent to the New York and Pennsylvania League, spending a few weeks there playing 26 games and hitting .452 with an OPS over 1. And he quickly moved up to the next level, hitting .297 the next year at Greenville. Not much power, and learning to get a batter's eye, he took 6 walks in 224 plate appearances. But he was playing well at first base. He's 19 years old, and the Red Sox kept him in A ball for 1970 at Danville.
He split time between first base and outfield, hitting .336 and had an on-base percentage of .415, so his eye is improving. After that season, the Cardinals saw his talent, and they selected Cooper in the Rule 5 draft. That draft was designed so that teams couldn't just stash guys in the minor leagues and leave them there forever. But before the 1971 season started, they decided not to keep him on the roster. And if you didn't keep a Rule 5 draft pick on the roster, you could send him back to the original team. And so Cecil goes back to the Red Sox. And shockingly, after those great few seasons, he started back at A-ball again. He hit .379 with 6 home runs, 3 triples in 42 games before getting called up to Double-A, which at that time was at Pawtucket.
He continued that great run at Double-A, hitting .343 with 10 more home runs, earning a late call-up to the Red Sox. The Red Sox had George Scott at first base, so there was a blocker ahead of Cecil, but he made the most of his time, hitting .310 in 14 games. It's pretty good. Going into 1972, he was expected to compete for the starting job as George Scott was traded to Milwaukee in the offseason. The Sox picked up Danny Cater from the Yankees, who was a solid, if unspectacular, veteran. So Cecil lost the matchup in spring training and was sent to AAA Louisville. Had a great year, hitting .315, 10 home runs, 9 triples, 31 doubles. And again, only had a late season cameo, just 17 at-bats. Meanwhile, Cater was not great, and then he was injured. But the Red Sox were in a close race in the AL East and didn't really want to take a chance on a rookie, so Carl Yastrzemski filled in at first base. They ultimately finished half a game behind Detroit. David, is this one of those sliding doors moments where Cecil Cooper making the stretch run at the end of the year could have put them over the top?
I didn't look to see what Yaz did at the end of the season, but this is definitely indicative of the way that the Red Sox treated Cecil Cooper and may have led to the way that we see Cecil Cooper now, as a forgotten one-time star rather than a Hall of Famer. He didn't really get a chance in 1973 either. The Red Sox stuck with Yaz at first base. Cooper's back at AAA. Pawtucket is now the AAA affiliate. And he was good, 293, 15 home runs. But this time, the late season call-up was different. The Red Sox ended up 8 games behind the Orioles, so they were competitive, but not in the same kind of pennant race. Cooper played in 30 games, starting 29 of them, and he didn't play great. He hit only .238, but after that, he never went back to the minors. The Red Sox had Cecil as their opening day starter in 1974, but the next couple seasons, he platooned, playing some at first base, some at DH, first season hitting .275. And the Red Sox were concerned about his glove, which is interesting because later he would be a gold glove first baseman. They had him play sparingly at first base to start the season. He only had 25 plate appearances through the end of May. But by the end of June, he was hitting well, earned more regular playing time. And this was a good lineup with rookies like Fred Lynn and Jim Rice, and also Dwight Evans, Carlton Fisk, and an aging but still good Yastrzemski. Cooper hit .366 in June, .346 in July, .337 in August, helping the Red Sox maintain a solid lead in the American League East. In early September, though, he was hit in the face by a pitch, which required him to be stretchered off the field, and he struggled after that, hitting .188 to close out the season. But still, he appeared in 100-plus games, hit .311 with 14 home runs, as the Red Sox won 95 games to make the playoffs.
A Jim Rice wrist injury forced Yaz to cover the outfield, and Cooper gets a starting job at first for the ALCS, going 4-for-10 as Boston swept Oakland to make it to the World Series, where they faced the Reds. In the World Series, Cecil was held to just one hit in 19 at-bats as Big Red Machine took the title in 7 games. In 1976, he continued to split time between first base and DH, playing well, .282, 15 homers, 78 RBIs, and a .110 OPS plus. Not spectacular, but a pretty good DH. Mid-season, the Red Sox fired manager Darryl Johnson, and Don Zimmer was his replacement. And Zimmer told Cooper he would be the starting first baseman heading into the next season. Then on December 6th, he was traded to Milwaukee for 2 former Red Sox, George Scott and Bernie Carbo.
Scott had been sent to the Brewers in 1971, opening a spot seemingly for Cecil. George Scott would be an all-star in 1977, but that was his last productive season, retiring after 1979. Bernie Carbo had just been traded to the Brewers earlier in 1976 and then was sent back to the Red Sox. He would be decent in limited work in 1977, but also out of baseball by 1980. This trade wasn't particularly popular in either city. Scott had been pretty popular for the Brewers and the Selig family. Bud Selig got some guff for this. The team had been in last place, and now they're trading away their all-star first baseman. But Cooper would go on to become a club legend. This looks initially like a step down from the big market Red Sox, having played in the World Series, down to a small market team that lost 95 games in 1976. But the Brewers gave Cecil a chance to start, and they would build a great team with him as one of the key pieces of that team. They already had 21-year-old Robin Yount, who's in his fourth season. Cooper would hit .300 his first year with 20 home runs in a career-high 160 games. This is the first time in his career he gets 600 plate appearances, and he made the most of it.
In 1978, he hit .312. As the Brewers won 93 games to challenge for the AL East, Cooper was limited to 107 games due to a broken leg suffered in June, and then turned a corner in 1979, becoming one of the best offensive players in baseball over the next 5 years. We have a few firsts for Cecil in 1979. His first black ink, leading the American League with 44 doubles. He made his first All-Star game, taking a walk in his one plate appearance. He had his first 100 RBI season, and he won a gold glove. Former teammate Sal Bando said, "Cooper can beat you with a home run or a flare to left or a bunt, and he can field his position. You have guys who can hit home runs and guys who can hit singles, but not many can do both."
The guy who we see on this card looks like a giant and looks like a big slugger. But Cecil Cooper also was a 200 hit guy. The first time he had 200 hits was 1980, and we have huge numbers on the back of this card. A 352 batting average, 155 OPS plus, 219 hits, 25 homers. He led the American League with 335 bases and led the league with 122 RBIs. He made his second All-Star game, won his second Gold Glove, his first Silver Slugger, a huge year, and yet he finished fifth in MVP voting. That huge batting average was overshadowed by George Brett, who was hitting 400 into September for the Kansas City Royals, who would win the AL West. Meanwhile, Cooper's having his great season for the third place Brewers. Cooper said, "I didn't expect to get much publicity, and I didn't have any trouble living with that." He never really looked for the spotlight and was happy to play in Milwaukee, happy to do well and get the respect of his teammates and his fans. But in this season, where you would look at big RBI numbers, a big batting average, and think, yeah, maybe that's an MVP season, unfortunately, he was overshadowed.
That season, Cooper was part of a historic game. The Brewers beat his former team, the Red Sox, 18-0. He and Don Money both hit grand slams in the same inning, which was only the fourth time that that had happened. And since then, it has happened a couple more times, including Fernando Tatis, who hit two himself in the same inning, and in a 2006 game in which the Mets hit two against the Cubs. A game that David was at and somehow missed both grand slams. David, how'd that happen?
So at a Cubs game, they stopped selling beer in the sixth inning. Both of those grand slams happened in the sixth inning. Both times I was waiting in the beer line.
Oh, it's a shame.
I just looked back and tried to figure this out. I did the math and I think it makes sense. I think in my life I've never seen a grand slam in person. And yet I was at this game where two in the same inning and I was tasked with getting beer.
Maybe you'll see Shohei Ohtani hit one later this year. Wrapping up the MVP talk, Cooper finished fifth in MVP voting behind George Brett, Reggie Jackson, Goose Gossage, and Willie Wilson. No respect, I tell ya. Yankees catcher Rick Cerrone got a first-place vote. Yes, Rick Cerrone, and yet no one gave Cecil Cooper a first-place vote with his .352 batting average. 1981, Cecil was good in the strike year, hitting .320, leading the majors with 35 doubles. Again, some more black ink on the baseball card, winning a second straight Silver Slugger. The Brewers win the AL East in the second half of the season, earning an appearance in the playoffs. And this American League Division Series was a best of five against the Yankees, and it went the full five games. Cecil had hits in four of the five games, but only singles, going 4-for-18 overall, driving in three and scoring one run. It was not meant to be in the playoffs, but they had a great lineup this year. Paul Molitor, Robin Yount, Cecil Cooper, Ted Simmons, Gorman Thomas, Ben Ogilvie, Jim Gumby Gantner, and Sal Bando. So failing in the playoffs, they seemed primed for 1982.
But then they started slow. Under Buck Rogers, they started 23-24, getting Buck Rogers fired. Harvey Keene takes over, and they go 72-43 to close out the season. They led the majors in homers and total bases. They had the highest team OPS plus since Babe Ruth's Yankees. A 121 OPS plus, 21% better than the league average. For a modern comparison, the 2023 Braves hit 307 homers and they had a 123 OPS plus, so just slightly better than this Brewers team. The team was nicknamed Harvey's Wallbangers. There's a little bit of mixology history. Harvey Wallbanger is a screwdriver with Galliano. And Galliano is an Italian herbal liqueur. This drink was created to market Galliano, and it was created by a marketing department, and one cocktail historian called it the first successful consultant-created cocktail. So a screwdriver with herbal hints, but it has a fun name. You know, it doesn't really seem like a strong beverage, but that's a strong name. It's a fun team name as well.
It's the vodka part that's strong, to be fair.
True. True. Well, Cooper had a characteristically great season for Harvey and the Wallbangers, hitting .313 with a career-high 32 homers, good for fifth in the American League. He had over 200 hits again, drove in 121, scored 104, and had a 142 OPS plus. He was the starting first baseman in the All-Star game, and he got a hit. And the Brewers won 95 games. This season went down to the wire, and with the final four-game series at Baltimore, who were in second place in the division, they had the chance to win it. All they needed to win was one game to secure the division. They were heavy favorites, and then they lost the first three games by a combined score of 26-7.
The final game of the season is on a Sunday. They're tied and in front of more than 50,000 Orioles fans, and the game's matchup is Jim Palmer versus Don Sutton. Palmer gives up three runs in the first three innings, including two homers to Robin Yount. But on the other side, Don Sutton, a late-season pickup from the Astros, gave up only two runs. Cecil Cooper homered in the sixth inning for the fourth run, helping to chase Palmer from the game. He would double in two runs in the ninth, and the Brewers won 10-2, taking the division. We're going to the playoffs again, this time against the California Angels. This was the first playoff series between two expansion teams, as California came into the league in 1961 and Milwaukee came in 1969, initially as the Seattle Pilots before moving. Neither team had ever won a pennant, so this would also be a first for either of the teams. The Angels took the first two games at home, 8-3 and 4-2. Cecil went 1-for-8 with an RBI in those two losses. The Brewers stormed back, winning the next two games, getting strong performances from Don Sutton and Moose Haas. Cooper was 1-for-8 in those two games as well, with an RBI and a run. And then in the decisive Game 5, the Angels were up 3-2 in the seventh inning.
We're at Milwaukee County Stadium. The seventh inning starts with singles by Charlie Moore and Gumby Gantner. Pitcher Luis Sanchez gets Paul Molitor to pop out for the second out, and he walks Robin Yount. Cecil comes up to the plate having gone 2-for-19 in the series with the bases loaded, two outs, and he'd faced Sanchez once in 1982, getting a single in May. After fouling off a pitch and taking a ball, we should probably go to the video to at least talk about Cecil Cooper's stance for a minute.
Try to get a strike to hit. He can tie this ball game up with ball four. He can work the pitcher to that. And being patient, you want to get a good pitch to hit, or if they're going to let you walk the first, do it.
Left field, base hit, tying run, Moore comes to score. Gantner on his way to the plate, throw through, Brewers lead.
You just can't keep giving Cecil Cooper opportunities to beat you because he will beat you.
Yeah, so this stance, he has a very open stance. He's open almost all the way to first base and keeps his weight very much on his back foot. So it's almost like he's slouching backwards. It's, I would say, a very relaxed stance.
And he switched to this open stance when he came to Milwaukee, and that was part of what made him the star and improved his play when he got to Milwaukee. It allowed him to hit outside pitches and also pull inside pitches. It's similar to Rod Carew's stance. He has this little waggle of the bat, pointing it at the pitcher, staring down the pitcher, and then he puts that bat flat behind him with that open stance. It's interesting. It's definitely distinctive and doesn't look like it would result in this picture on the card. It looks like he wouldn't be standing up that straight, the picture that's on the card. So maybe he eased up on that crouch as he got a little bit older. But it's definitely a distinctive stance. So Cooper slaps the ball to left field, dropping it just in front of Brian Downing, who took an odd path to the ball. Charlie Moore comes in to score, and Downing's throw was up the first baseline. So Jim Gantner slides headfirst to score the go-ahead run. And after the hit, you can see Cooper waving his arms down, the opposite of a Carlton Fisk. And he was yelling, get down, ball. And the crowd was so loud that he couldn't hear himself saying anything, but he said, I just wanted to keep waving so the ball would fall in there. The fans are going nuts. There's streamers getting thrown into the air, pandemonium. This is only Cooper's third hit of the postseason, but it was definitely the biggest hit of his career. And the Brew Crew go on to win the ALCS and go to their first World Series.
And this World Series is the Suds Series against the Cardinals, Milwaukee and St. Louis, both famous beer towns. Cooper had a good series too, going 8-for-28 with a home run and a Game 3 loss. He drove in runs in Games 4 and 5, which were both Brewers wins. In Game 6, the Cardinals won in a blowout, and although Cecil went 1-for-3 with an RBI, his team lost Game 7, 6-3. The Brewers were without Raleigh Fingers for the series, and it went to 7 games. Cecil would later say, if Raleigh had been healthy, the Brew Crew would have been world champions, and I got to agree with him.
Maybe. Game 2 was close, but most of the other games were not situated so that a closer, even one of Raleigh's quality, could have flipped him. Something else that Cecil pointed out was that it changed the way that the Brewers had to use their bullpen. So bumping everybody from their normal spot threw everybody out of their rhythm. And so it is an interesting what if. And Cecil said, we were short-armed, didn't have all our guys, and Raleigh was the biggest component of all. So a tough end for a great season in Milwaukee.
With that .313 batting average, Cecil finished fifth in MVP voting, but his teammate, Robin Yount, rightfully won the award. When asked about his luck in these MVP races, Cecil said, it's not often a guy hits .390. And how many times does a shortstop lead the league in slugging percentage? So obviously insinuating that Robin Yount had rightfully earned the award. The next season, the Brewers won 87 games, but finished fifth in the AL East. Cooper started slow, hitting only .228 on May 16th. But from that point forward, he hit .326. So a slow start and a strong finish. He earned his fourth All-Star appearance and finished the season with a .307 average, .137 OPS plus. He led the American League with 126 RBIs, hit 30 home runs, had 203 hits, and had a career best, 106 runs scored. And once again, fifth in MVP voting.
Just, again, no respect. 1984, though, was a down year for him. For the first time in Milwaukee, he hit under .300, and he was 34 years old. He hit .275 with 11 home runs, and it was a down year for everyone on the Brewers. They lost 90-plus games. He bounced back in 1985, making his final All-Star game, hitting .293, driving in 99 runs for another under .500 Milwaukee team. But as we get to the bottom of this card, 1986 and 87, he starts missing some time. His average and power are dropping off. And particularly in 1987, where the Brewers have a really great team streak, great guys like Mark Chardy, Juan Neves, but also Paul Molitor. Paul Molitor is playing DH, and so that ends up relegating Cooper to the bench. And he didn't get much playing time. He appeared in only 63 games. And that's the last line on the card. And the real reason that he was not playing was unclear to a lot of fans. Fans wanted to see this club legend. They knew that he was getting up in age and maybe this was his last season or getting near to the end of his career. But he didn't get an at-bat after the All-Star break. Journalists were questioning why a club that was seemingly in contention wasn't using all of their players. Sources said that Cooper was going to be released. But if they cut Cooper mid-season, the team would be on the hook for his entire 1988 salary and deferred money that the team owed him from a contract renegotiation, and they would have had to pay him $1.5 million. So the team's trying to trade him, they can't find a trade partner, and so he just sat on the bench. With 9 games left, Cooper, who was normally pretty quiet, pretty reserved, said, "How should I feel? Happy? Sad? That's how it is, sad. I'm disappointed that it had to end this way. You could say bitter. I think I've done a lot for this organization." I think looking at the back of this card, you can see Cooper did a lot for this organization, and the fans knew it. At the final game of the season, they were chanting, "We want Coop." But even though the Brewers won 9-6, they still didn't put him in the game. At the end of the game, the team stood in front of the dugout as the fans were cheering, and they were calling for Cooper. Coaches were asking him to go out onto the field for a curtain call. Instead, he gathered his stuff, and he left.
A few months later, Cecil was released and decided to retire, which is a sad end to a great Brewers career. Closing the book on Cecil Cooper, 17 seasons in the major leagues, batting average of .298 with 2,192 hits, 241 home runs, 1,125 RBIs, and 1,012 runs scored, a career OPS plus of 121, and valued at 36 WAR by Baseball Reference. 5 times an All-Star, 3 times Silver Slugger, 2-time Gold Glove winner, In the Hall of Fame, he got 0 votes in his first time on the ballot. How about in retirement?
He wasn't quite done playing. He played for 1 month in the Senior Professional Baseball Association in 1989. This association had some great players, all of whom were 35 years or older. Cecil, Raleigh Fingers, Vita Blue, Dave Kingman, Fergie Jenkins all played in the Senior League. And Cecil appeared in 16 games with the Winter Haven Super Sox and hit .407 with 3 homers and 15 RBIs. That league only lasted 1 season and then folded. He didn't really have a plan when he retired. He didn't expect his career to end as it did. And so when he decided to step away from the game, he talked to his own agent, who suggested maybe he should join the ranks of agents. Cooper said, let's give it a shot. And so for 8 years, he represented some big names, Wade Boggs, Randy Johnson, Joe Girardi, and he enjoyed doing that. But he also stayed close despite that negative end to his time with the Brewers. He stayed close with the Selig family, and they reached out to him about taking a role with the club. He initially was the Brewers' farm director for 5 seasons, something that Cecil has described as an incredibly difficult job managing the teams and budgets of multiple clubs throughout the minor league system. And then in 2002, he was named the Brewers' bench coach. He later managed the club's AAA team. And in 2005, he took an opportunity to get back closer to his Texas home, and he joined the Astros as Phil Garner's bench coach. When Garner was fired in 2007, Cooper became the interim manager. He was hired full-time on a 2-year contract, finishing over .500 in 2008. But then in 2009, with 13 games left in the season and the Astros having a big payroll and some aging stars, and yet finishing under .500, they let Cooper go. He still lives in Texas with his wife and has 3 adult daughters, Kelly, Brittany, and Tori.
So, David, we started this episode just admiring this dude's huge forearms as he's crushing a ball on the front of this card. Now we've got a guy whose borderline Hall of Fame credentials was multiple-year All-Star, and he's just not a name I've heard very much. I heard much more about Cecil Fielder, for example, than I ever did about Cecil Cooper. So now, after looking into his background a little bit more, what should we think?
Despite that late career mistreatment in Milwaukee, he is a Milwaukee Brewers legend. The fans never forgot both the stats that he put up and that huge moment in 1982 to send them to the World Series. On the Brewers leaderboard, he is 4th in career WAR for position players, 4th in offensive WAR, 3rd with a .302 batting average in his time in Milwaukee. He's also in the top 10 in hits, runs, total bases, doubles, triples, homers, RBIs, and OPS plus. And he's also on the single season offensive leaderboard for Milwaukee. His 1980 season, that excellent year, 219 hits is the single season record for Milwaukee, and his .352 average is 2nd all time. For RBIs, he shows up 3 times in the top 10, and that career with Milwaukee was recognized. In 2002, he was inducted into the Walk of Fame at Miller Park. That same year, he was inducted into the Wisconsin Athletic Hall of Fame. And in 2014, Cooper was inducted into the Wall of Honor outside Miller Park. So Cecil's peak was outstanding. He was, between 1979 and 1983, one of the best players in baseball. He hit .320, a .143 OPS plus, 123 home runs. He had more hits and RBIs than anyone in baseball. 942 hits over that 5-season stretch, 535 RBIs. He was 11th in overall WAR during that stretch, but offensively he was 5th, behind Mike Schmidt, George Brett, Robin Yount, and Andre Dawson. He was in the top 5 in MVP voting 3 times, but he wasn't even the best player on his own team. Mm. And so he was overshadowed by even his own teammate, by George Brett, by other big-time first basemen in the 80s. And that's maybe why he's not as well-known as those other guys. His peak was short. He was also older. He was 29 to 33 during that stretch. His playing time in Boston is probably what keeps him out of the Hall of Fame. He didn't get 600 plate appearances until he was 27 years old in Milwaukee. And when he finally got that chance, he became one of the best players in baseball. If he had put up anything close to those numbers during his 21 to 26 seasons, he would have gotten much more recognition, at least gotten a single vote for the Hall of Fame. Instead, his first 6 seasons, he's worth a 5 WAR total. Stuck on the bench behind a mid-30s Yaz and others, and so he didn't ever get his chance in Boston, and finally gets it in small-market Milwaukee. But Cooper never really cared about accolades or about the press. He was secure in his stardom, and he didn't need the adulation or awards. As the youngest of 13, he was used to sharing attention while growing up. And in 1983, when he's asked about the MVP votes, he deflected and just said, "One thing is certain, I won't lose any sleep if I don't get the award." He also went out of his way to praise the other players who were ahead of him, who were being considered. And he also said, "Maybe I'm the Lou Gehrig of my time, always in the shadow of someone else. He's a pretty good role model, though." And he wasn't saying that boastfully, although he had room to boast. He was one of the best first basemen in baseball, one of the best players in baseball, but he was overlooked because he was consistent but rarely flashy. And he also, under the radar, did a lot of good work in Milwaukee, working with underprivileged kids, and for his efforts, he was awarded the 1983 Roberto Clemente Award. He also didn't like the spotlight. He said he was fine in small groups, but when he was asked to speak in front of big crowds, he just locked up. He said, "I'd play in front of 50,000 people, and that doesn't bother me." He went on stage at a Red Sox banquet, and he got through his first three or four lines, and he couldn't get any more out. So he preferred to just go home after games and wasn't looking for the press, wasn't looking for self-promotion. He preferred to just go home and hang out with his kids and with his wife. So a good guy from humble beginnings who really made the most of his opportunity when it was finally given.
Getting no respect, left entirely off the Hall of Fame ballot. But he did get respect where it mattered from fans in Milwaukee, from his family, friends, and teammates, and certainly by the 1988 Tops podcast. I'm happy to put him somewhere on our Wall of Fame, wherever that may be. But I do like the thought of that as the youngest of 13 kids. You know that there's really not going to be much of a deal made about you. What a great career and a great story. So thank you, David, for the story. And thank you to you at home. If you've got room in your freezer for some mint chocolate chip Bluebell ice cream, describe it to us on Threads. We're at 1988 Tops Podcast. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you next week.